history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories to be heard. If we just take the time to ask a few questions and listen, we'll be amazed by what our veterans have been through. And we want them to know, we want our veterans to know that we appreciate their service and sacrifice, that we're not going to forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we hear these stories, we are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these members of our greatest generation. And the gentleman we're going to meet today, what a life story. I mean, you could make a movie out of this. Mike DeCesar, 88 years old, lives near Madera, California. I think I saw an alpaca on the way in here, Mike, and I don't know if we're going to get into that, but your life story, I'm just amazed here. You lost your mother. You never knew your mother, right?
No, she passed away a day after I was born.
But you're one of eight children.
Eight children.
And all five of you boys were in uniform in World War II. You were way before you were even old enough to, and we're going to find out about that. But I want to hear about your childhood. What was it like growing up without a mom, and what happened to all the different kids, and how many different directions did you guys go in?
Well, actually, when my mother passed away the day after I was born, she was still young. She was only 25 years old. My brothers went into Catholic homes in New Jersey. My sisters went into Catholic convents. My grandparents, which was my mother's parents, since I was only a couple of days old, they didn't want to release me, even though they had six kids of their own. And they kept me and raised me. And they had relatives that lived in Fresno. They were farmers. They had 144 acres. They had no children. And when they came back east to visit their parents, who lived down the street from my grandparents, they happened to see me. As a matter of fact, even at that age, I was getting out of school at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was working in a blacksmith shop. It's called Joe Carolina. And my job was to rake up all the slag in the dirt floor and clean all the tools and put them away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd work every day, like maybe 3 hours and half a day on Saturday.
That's at 9 years old.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And back then, well, I was 9 years old, but I was like 30 years old streets. So when these folks came out here and they saw me and they convinced my grandparents to let me move to Fresno. They said, you know, we have no children and he can work on the farm. He can make money and help you out. So that's how I ended up in Fresno.
How did you feel about that?
Well, quite frankly, I felt good about it because I didn't want to end my life working in a factory back in New Jersey. And most of the fellas that were my childhood buddies, that's what they ended up doing, working in factories or doing other things. Some of them ended up in, we call it the college, which is the state prison. So when I heard about California, of course, you know, we would see a vehicle in town with California tags and you'd go berserk. So I was all for it. And the folks that raised me out here, they raised plums, and they raised apricots that we used to cut and put them on trays. And we had 10 acres of truck farming. And when we were done with that, then we would go and do everything from pick olives to shaking them when they're black or picking them by hand when they're green, cutting oranges, cutting lemons. I was making a lot of money. But, of course, in the meantime, the war comes along, and I get news that my twin brothers, the oldest brothers, whom I never knew, lost their life. They were in the Army Air Corps in Hawaii on December 7th. And then my next brother, he ends up joining the Navy. And the brother before me, he ends up joining the Navy Air Force or the Air Corps. And I just wanted to get off the farm. It was a combination of things. I was angry at the time, losing my brothers. I wasn't quite 16 years old, but I kind of jimmied my baptismal certificate. In those days, they took anything. You can go in with a parking ticket. So anyhow, I got in, and I actually ran away. And I went through boot camp, and I was waiting to be transferred when I got notified that I had to report to division headquarters, and I didn't know what this was all about. Well, they found out I was underage, so they told me I'd have to leave the service. I was just scan under 16. So they gave me a train ticket. They said, you can come back and reenlist. I believe at the time it was 90 days before your 17th birthday, but you had to have parental approval.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't have any parents, and these folks didn't adopt me. But what they did through Fresno Superior Court, I appointed them as my guardians. So just about 3 months before my 17th birthday, which was in the mid-1944, I went down, had the court document with a seal on it. They made me sign up, and they said, well, the day you're 17, you report here, and you'll be on the train. Of course, I had to go back to boot camp, but by then I was like an old salt, you know. I'd just walk around with a cup of coffee because I'd already been through boot camp. Then from there, you know, I got assigned to sea duty. And
I want to hear about all that. And I'm imagining folks listening. I know a little bit about your story, but people are listening and they're hearing this for the first time. They're saying, holy cow, his mom died right after he was born. Didn't know his siblings at all. Goes cross country on the train at 9. Then, oh, by the way, when America gets this word of World War II, the December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Everybody has a memory about how they found out and, you know, what that news meant to him. But for you, it's, hey, two brothers that I never got a chance to know are dead. Do you remember that day, how you found out, and then at what point you learned, you know what, my brothers were part of that?
Yeah, I remember that day very clear because the farm that the folks that raised me on was actually owned by Japanese. It was the Yoshida family.
Mm-hmm.
Very well known. In fact, some of the fellas served in the 442. And the one brother, I think, was quite an athlete at Fresno State. But because they moved him out, Frank who and Mary, the folks that raised me, they worked on that farm. But they took care of that farm while these folks were gone. The money for the crops and all, they put that away for them. And, of course, they would not come back to Fresno after the war was over because they were interned. Frank ended up buying the farm. So I distinctly remember the day that that happened. In fact, we were out in the packing shed, and he had a radio out there, an old Philco radio. We were hearing about the Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor. Of course, I didn't realize my brothers were in Hawaii.
Right.
I didn't know that until a couple of months later, and then I heard about it, and their name was Victor and Vito. They were twins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really only got to know my one brother, who did 30 years as a battleship sailor, and as I mentioned to you, he was on the Texas in the Normandy invasion and was wounded. So the only one that I really knew, not that well, was him. And of course, then I had my oldest sister, who just passed away this past year. I was very close with her, and that's about the only family that I really knew.
Mm-hmm.
I've never sat at the same table with brothers and sisters.
In many ways, you've been on your own for a very long time.
Yeah, so like I say, I was young, but I learned how to survive.
And so when Pearl Harbor happens, you're what, 13 years old?
I think I was just a little over 13, yeah. You know, there was a lot of hurt. There was a lot of anger. I think at that time, a lot of people were pretty mad at the Japanese. Unfortunately, they took it out on the American Japanese.
Well, and you must have had interesting perspective on that, having worked on this farm owned by Japanese Americans. You probably didn't think of them as any different from anyone else, right?
No. In fact, they were wonderful people, let me tell you. Mrs. Ishida, she was, I can only say when she died, she must have went straight to heaven nonstop. She was a wonderful person. I mean, the whole family was great. I can imagine or try to imagine that you get notice tomorrow morning, have your bags ready, and that's it. Take you away from your home and leave everything behind. It must have been devastating to these people.
And you're a teenager watching this happen to people you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I remember Frank just told him, and he embraced him and said that I'll take care of your place for you, and I'll make sure that everything will be here when it's over. I mean, that's very vivid to me. But, you know, it was a difficult time for me at that time.
You were talking about the work you did at the age of 9 and how you'd get done at school at 1 o'clock and get to work and work on the weekends and all that. I said, well, I guess if you start working early, then you keep working a long time because here you are. Before long, you're going to be 90, and I don't think you're going to have stopped working yet.
No, I don't think so. In fact, doctors tell me at the VA, I don't have a better medicine to give you. Of course, when I came out here, I never went back to school. Once again, thanks to the military, they had a program, and I don't know whether it's still in force. We used to call it USAFI, stands for United States Armed Forces Institute. It was a correspondence course. You can take your tests. You had to do it in front of two officers, and if you passed, you got a GED certificate, which I did. And I did 2 years of junior college and came out. Under the GI Bill, I was able to attend LaSalle University. I got a law degree. I never took the bar. I went to work for insurance companies in the litigation division. I've been doing that now for going on 61 years. So thanks to the Navy and thanks to the military, and I think about the young kids today that will not have an opportunity to finish high school and will never go to college, and they should set their sights on the military. It's not all fighting on the front line. You You can learn a trade, do your 20 years, good benefits, GI Bill. It was a great life. And I can honestly say that, without exaggerating, I never had a bad day in the Navy.
Well, I want to hear about some of those days, and some other people might have a different opinion. They might have felt it was a bad day, and it might just be your perspective. But so you're 16 years old. You're not quite 17 when they actually let you back in.
Yes.
Right? Official this time. You're no longer lying about your age. How did you end up in submarines? Is that something you volunteered for?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, when I went back in, I noticed on a bulletin board they had a notice up there that they were looking for volunteers for the submarine service. And of course, at that age, you know, you're curious. I thought, wow, that's really got to be something. So they did a 2-day tour. I think there was 21 or 22 of us. And they took us to New London, and we went aboard. Of course, these are the old diesel electric, the Gatto class and those classes, and went through them and seen them. And I mean, the more you seen, the more you got excited. So I decided, okay, so I got it. And they took us out on one of the older boats. They call them boats. They don't call them ships.
Right.
We were out about 100 miles offshore in the Atlantic, and all of the candidates had headsets on. These are all voice power activated, and you hear everything that's going on. They had a whole bunch of chief petty officers with charts, and they would watch each person and mark and see how they act. And all of a sudden, everything went black and everything stopped. I mean, you're under the water, the electric motors, you hear the whirring of the motors, whirring of it, and everything stops. And then you hear the captain. He said, "We've lost all power. We're going to ease down to the bottom." You can feel hitting the bottom. We're probably down about maybe 110 feet. And then you're hearing back and forth, you know, "Well, we got this problem, we got that problem," and you're listening to it, all the candidates, and they're watching you. And guys that start to look like they're going to panic, they start grading them. We're down there about 4.5 hours.
With no power that whole time?
No power. The only thing we have on is battle lights, which are battery lanterns.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, the captain comes on and he says, "Chief engineer tells us we have one chance to get to the surface. If you see a blue flash go through the boat, I'll see you topside. If you don't see the blue flash, I'm going to be topside. Some of you guys may be down below," meaning heaven or hell.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, the blue flash happened. We get up to the top. Then we find out it was a training process. Well, out of 22, there was only, I think, 4 of us that passed. They flunked the rest of them out.
Were you on the verge of panic, or were you calm, cool, and collected the whole time?
No, I figured, hey, you know, I can't get out, so I may as well.
Where am I going to go?
Where am I going to go? I mean, you know, I'm sure the captain and everybody else wants to go home, so I'll just stick with it. What's going to happen is going to happen.
And you're probably the youngest kid in there.
I was, as a matter of fact, yeah. That's what they used to call me, Mikey the Kid.
Uh-huh.
That was my title.
What do you mean used to?
No, they just call me Mike.
And I think we can call him full of surprises. Time for a break, but when we come back, we'll hear about his experiences on submarines in the Pacific during World War II, as well as his work right after the war as a salvage diver with primitive equipment like you saw Cuba Gooding Jr. use in the film Men of Honor. Check out Mike's photos and videos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.